Oh, thank you, Gordon, by the way, for allowing me not to admit that I'm a quarter Belgian.
Oh, right, yeah, okay. Well, we'll edit that back in somehow. Yeah.
It's Friday, March 15th, and this is the Dutch News Podcast, your weekly chance to catch up with what's been going on here in the Netherlands. I am Paul Peter, civil engineer and CDA Almere fan. And with me is Gordon Derek, contributing editor at Dutch News and a ballot paper mourner. And we are joined by a very special guest today, Robin Pasco, editor-in-chief of Dutch News and Amsterdam Web Tourist. Robin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, of course. Let's start with your job title, Amsterdam Web Tourist. Is this another Femke Halsema brainwave?
Yes, it's not Femke actually, it's her right-hand man, but yes, it is. It's their latest little project to stop the tourists coming to Amsterdam. And this is a website which you can helpfully fill in your wishes for your little trip. So bar crawl, visit a prostitute, take drugs, it's all in there.
Buy some cocaine.
Exactly. And then it explains to you why you shouldn't do it or you can't do it in Amsterdam. And it costs...
Which is an obvious lie.
Yeah, I know. I mean, they're not fooling anybody.
Yeah.
It's most odd. And this has cost ridiculous sums of money, €85,000, just for designing, you know, the world's worst and most unattractive website.
It's
I've
an online
seen.
Questionnaire, right? It's something you could have built in 2006 on your free AOL web space, and they spent €85,000 on it.
I know, and it's not going to work, and you can't find it. So we all know, you know, that to get, you know, high up on Google, they're going to pay, but you need a name. The name of this is AmsterdamRules.com.
Yeah.
I mean, who's going to look up AmsterdamRules.com?
Nobody.
Yeah, because somebody who spent, you know, a sabbatical at a UK university has thought that Amsterdam Rules is a clever play on words, saying, like, you know, Amsterdam Rules meaning Amsterdam is great, but actually this is the Amsterdam Rules, bro.
Exactly.
Right?
So a waste of money and a waste of time.
A waste of time, yeah. And a waste of space, although virtual space.
Yes.
And it's great because it does say things like, you know, it offers you, why are you coming to Amsterdam? Are you coming for a stag party? And then you click on stag party and it says stag party's a band. Or it says, do you want to go on a pub crawl? And then it says, it's forbidden to organise pub crawls. But who is policing this, right? How do you know if people just going from one bar to another are on a pub crawl? At what point does, you know, just to wander around the city become a pub crawl?
We could try it.
Also, it's not even forbidden, right? It's
no, how allowed, can you have, so... you cannot forbid pub crawls. You cannot forbid people from going out of one bar and going into another. It's just not, you know, I mean, that's, even the Nazis couldn't do that.
Did they try though?
They probably did actually.
Yeah. As I said, a waste of time, effort, money and everything. Typical Amsterdam, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm afraid it absolutely is typical. It's unbelievable. They'll never, ever, ever get it right.
Yeah, but I've had a lot of fun taking the mick out of them for getting it wrong repeatedly.
Yeah.
So we can look forward to that.
Things that were absolutely right and are going to be wrong, Gordon.
Yes.
The ballot papers, what is
happening? This is very sad news. This is terribly sad news. Another tradition has been taken away from us by, you know, by the Gartenhordel elite, who in their wisdom have decided that the in the sort of bedsheet-sized or tablecloth-sized voting papers that Dutch voters get.
A valued tradition.
Yeah, valued tradition. These enormous ballot papers that have a list of every single candidate from all 526 parties contesting every election. They're now going to be replaced with a sort of a much smaller A3 size sheet where you make two choices. First, you choose your party and then you choose your candidate from. But then you have to sort of consult a numbered list. So it's like a sort of a pick choose menu. It's like a sushi bar menu, basically. You have to sort of pick and choose, you know, your candidate from their list of candidates. So it makes the process of voting much more complicated, and it does away with these huge voting papers that sort of double as, you know, as tents, which for a nation that's so fond of camping, I think is very appropriate.
So if you're going to vote, you will be provided with a little booklet full of, with all the candidates basically listed. Are they also going to include little portraits of all the candidates?
Yeah, maybe they should.
They should do that.
They should do
then,
that.
Then the whole sushi menu thing is complete, I think.
It's only going to be available in 4 towns, though, to start with, just to test it out.
Yes. One of which is, I think, Tilburg or Oss, somewhere. It's quite a random selection of towns, I seem to remember, but I don't have the details to hand.
Even though wasn't it Tilburg the last election where they had to do a recount? So maybe this is their punishment.
Yeah, didn't they? Yeah.
They were finally fed up with these enormous sized ballot papers, which they had to count again and again and again. So they thought, yeah, this is getting out of hand. We need smaller ballot papers.
Yeah.
So thank you, Tilburg, again for ruining everything.
Yes. So not for the first time, but it's a very sad day when the last enormous ballot paper has been folded and put into the last ballot box.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And meanwhile, getting away from Tilburg, which is always a wise thing, Paul, you've been taking a very keen interest in what's been going on in Almere.
To be honest, I haven't been paying attention to what has been going on in Almere because I have absolutely no idea what CDA Almere was talking about. But they had issued, they had posted a already legendary tweet the other day. I believe on Sunday it was. Someone who was a member of the Christian Democrats in Almere was watching the 8 o'clock news. And he was annoyed by the fact that the NOS preferred to do an item on the death of the... It was the guy who came up with Dragon Ball Z in Japan, I believe.
Ah.
Also a legendary cartoon from my youth. So they dedicated an item to that. And this boomer, I imagine it is a boomer, in Almere, he angrily picked up his phone and tweeted... it's peculiar that the NS wants to do a very thorough, very lengthy item on the death of a Japanese
animator
who nobody knows, he added. But the political crisis in Almere is completely ignored. this has turned into a meme in the past week. So every time something happened, people would... respond or comment again, nothing about the political crisis in Almere. And to be honest, I haven't looked into what's actually going on in Almere, but I'm sure it is very interesting
and maybe they can make a cartoon about it
on Almere,
cartoon. Well, because you know that the Dutch hired Japanese animators to make that famous cartoon series Alfredo Dorcas Kruk. Right.
Oh, was
that was made
Japanese?
By Japanese animators. Yeah, if you look at the closing credits, it's all Japanese names. Because Japanese cartoons were very popular at that time. So they decided just bring in a load of Japanese animators to make this cartoon set in the Netherlands that would look very familiar to children who've grown up with their Japanese cartoons.
And if I could make a suggestion, I would say Almere would be the perfect location for a skyscraper-sized lizard to destroy the entire city.
Yes. It couldn't make it any worse.
No, not at all.
It will only be an improvement.
Yeah.
That brings us to the OPEF of the week. This time it comes from travel agency TUI, which is one of the few travel agencies that isn't owned by a former D66 minister. But they have been using colonial language in one of their advertisements. On its website, TUI invited holiday goers on a 14-day trip to Suriname, which is a former Dutch colony. And there the holiday goers could taste the plantation's atmospheres and step into the shoes of our brave forebears. The advertisement caused OPEF and outrage from all sides of...
All sensible people, basically.
But especially anti-racism group Kickout Zwarte Piet spoke out. They spotted the advertisement first and shared it on Instagram, and they said it is incomprehensible that advertisements like this are written in 2024, especially after the king had apologized last year for the Dutch role in the transatlantic slave trade. Suriname was a Dutch colony from 1667 until 1954, and until the abolition of slavery in 1863, its plantation industry depended entirely on slave labor. So, to speak of our brave forebears, it's a little bit insensitive. TUI has apologized for the description, and they have changed the wording in their brochure.
But they're still organizing the trips.
Yeah,
Yeah, of course.
But not without plantation atmospheres or stepping into footsteps of your colonial forebears.
Right.
But you can still go on a 14-day trip to Suriname if you want to.
Yeah.
It was probably written by the same people who did the Amsterdam City Council.
Very likely. Yeah. Well, Suriname now have set up a website to try and stop people going to Suriname and doing colonial tours. You know,
you can press a button, rubber plantation. They
could do like an exchange. You know, you can sort of swap a tour of the Wallen in Amsterdam with a tour of the slave plantations in Suriname.
Marvelous idea. This week, the impossible has happened. Progress in the formation process. The opening of Amsterdam's Holocaust Museum attracted hundreds of protesters to the Portuguese synagogue. The French will likely build the Netherlands' new submarines. I am in danger of being deported to Belgium, while Quincy Promes is not. He will be deported to somewhere else. Wolves in Drenthe will possibly end up with hearing loss, and not because they've been listening too much to Joost Klein.
After 2 days locked away in a country estate where one player was murdered every evening until only one remained... Oh, no, sorry, that's the wrong script. After 2 days locked away in a country estate near Hilversum, the four parties trying to form a new Dutch government finally came to an agreement. Sort of. Kim Putters, the floppy-haired Labour Party social scientist brought in to broker the talks, said the parties were ready to proceed with what he called a programme cabinet, programmatic cabinet. What are we calling this?
I have no idea. I've been struggling with it.
I just want to say a floppy-haired Labour Party social scientist sounds like a character from a Agatha Christie novel. So
yes.
It could be one character from a murder mystery. But yeah, program cabinet, I have no idea what it is. It's just another name. You know, we have so many names of forms of cabinets which nobody knows what it actually is, and now we just have another one added to that long list.
Yeah, it's typical of a sociologist to make up terms that nobody understands, right? I suppose we shouldn't really be surprised.
Exactly.
But yeah, it sort of sounds like it's a sort of cabinet where if it stops working, an engineer comes along to switch it off and switch it on again, which may well happen before too long. But anyway, the four parties, the PFFE, FFFE, NSC and BBB, will now sit down together and draw up an outline programme for government, which is a kind of looser form of coalition deal, although no one's really quite sure how loose or how long it should be.
Aren't we sure it is a looser form?
Well, it's a shorter form, certainly, and it's about, I think it seems to change every 2 minutes, but the idea seems to be they come up with a sort of outline deal or a framework or a set of targets almost, and then it's up to the ministers themselves to actually produce the detailed legislation, which will then be put before Parliament. I've actually lost myself here.
But, the only one thing matters here, Gordon. Who is going to be the Prime Minister?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's not Geert Wilders. That is the big news that came out on Wednesday evening. Geert Wilders will not be Prime Minister, even though he's been saying since the election he's looking forward to becoming Prime Minister of all Dutch people, even the ones that he's been insulting on Twitter ever since. But Wilders posted again on Twitter, or X as we call it these days, this week, that he wanted to lead the cabinet, but he couldn't count on the support of all four parties, and so he was nobly prepared to set aside his personal ambitions for the good of the country and the voters who are so close to his heart. And in fact, all four party leaders had to agree to keep their seats in Parliament. And Peter Omtzigt then, who is also making up the rules as he goes along, said this is a hallmark of an extra parliamentary cabinet. And nobody can contradict him because we've never had one before. So if Omtzigt says it's an extra parliamentary cabinet, then it is. So Yeschelgers, who is currently Justice Minister, remember, will not be in cabinet now. And neither will Peter Omtzigt, and neither will Caroline van der Plas, the leader of the Farmers Party, BBB.
But I imagine Wilders took it very well for a guy who had his heart set on Rutte's office.
Well, on Wednesday it sounded like he was quite content with it, but he must have slept badly because on Thursday morning he woke up and went on camera to stamp his feet and complain that it was all very terribly undemocratic and unfair and unconstitutional, even though the position of Prime Minister is not mentioned anywhere in the Constitution. He blamed Peter Omtzigt, the leader of NSC, for undermining him and said only baby leader Caroline van der Plas had backed his ambition to become Prime Minister. Fefe Daly, the deal on Yeschelgers, said she hadn't blocked Wilders, but she also hadn't automatically agreed to him, which is a very Fefe Daly type rejection. It's like when an interviewer says, we'll keep your CV on file, right?
It doesn't sound like a great, you know, start, really, does it? Not a lot of trust there.
No, absolutely zero trust, especially when you look at how Wilders and Omtzigt are talked about, or rather how Wilders has talked about Omtzigt in Parliament and on Twitter in the last few weeks. And of course, the fact that Omtzigt walked out of the talks, said he wasn't going to take part, and then went back and said, OK, I will, but only if Wilders does not become Prime Minister. Because let's face it, this is all about stopping Wilders being leader of the cabinet. And the fact that the other party leaders also agreed to sit in Parliament was kind of a compromise or a cover for that.
So who actually wants this programme cabinet then?
Well, I think Kim Putters is quite keen on it because it gives him a chance to go back to his day job as a chair of the Socioeconomic Council. There's going to be a debate in Parliament on next Wednesday, and at that point they will appoint the person to lead the next stage of the talks, which Putters hasn't ruled himself out of this, but we'll see. And again, it'll be up to Geert Wilders to decide who that person is. Peter Omtzigt also is quite keen on, an unorthodox cabinet formation. He said he favours an extra parliamentary cabinet, there's that term again, because he claims it allows legislation to be scrutinised by all parties, and there's no collective responsibility as you have under regular coalitions. So then if one party that is backing the government decides it doesn't like a piece of legislation, it can vote against it or criticise it without threatening the existence of the cabinet, theoretically. But of course in practice it's going to be a gigantic mess, right? Because you're going to have Wilders. This also, I think, plays a lot into Wilders' hands for all the bluster he's come up with, saying that this is a terribly undemocratic process. It gives him the freedom to behave like an opposition leader when he wants to, much as he did when he was back in the cabinet between 2010 and 2012, where if he didn't like something, he'd just stand up and shout about it in Parliament and nobody could stop him because he wasn't actually formally in the cabinet. And with
not only him, but also the other parties, right? And whenever there needs to be, they need to make a tough decision or a painful compromise needs to be reached, all these parties don't have any motivation to stick together, because after all they don't have any one of their personal their party members in the cabinet, so there's no glory for them to reach there. I've foresee at the very first political crisis that this cabinet, this loose cabinet, will fall apart because there is simply no glue that holds them together in form of they don't have any. Usually when you form a coalition, you need to make painful compromises, but in exchange you get all sorts of nice items from your party's candidate, from your party's wish list, and this is no longer the case in this form.
Fortunately, there aren't any big difficult issues to face, like a nitrogen or the climate change fund or the war in Ukraine or the fact that there's a looming economic crisis, none of that, or compensating the Tuzlak and the Fera victims, or everything's going to be plain sailing for the next couple of years, right?
Be quite honest, we haven't had a cabinet for how long now? Quite a few days, 3 months, something like that.
Since July, because when the last one fell apart. Yeah.
Well, that's true. The country seems to be running quite well, actually. I don't think we need one at all.
Well, I think that's an interesting point because I've seen a few people say that we have effectively an extra parliamentary cabinet now it's a minority cabinet, but also, of course, again, they're not in a formal coalition anymore. So effectively, they're now having to put their legislation through piecemeal, and sometimes they clash with Parliament, and sometimes Parliament supports them. But they
have been in a caretaker position for so long that certain dossiers they simply cannot ignore anymore. So they need to act on it. For example, the submarine thing, right? The submarine order, which we will talk later in the podcast.
Yeah.
That's 6 billion euros, which they decide on. Usually a caretaker cabinet would never make a decision that is about so much money. And there are all sorts of political decisions on the table that they are going to just govern. They're simply governing, but not with a majority anymore.
Yeah, and the flip side of the coin is that sometimes Parliament is taking decisions in its own hands, like the decision on Lelystad Airport, which we talked about during our special episode last week, which is a good opportunity to plug that. But anyway. So under this construction, the idea here is that some ministerial posts will be filled by the parties in Parliament or the parties that are negotiating now, but some will come from outside. They could appoint people from other parties. That are, so the distinction between government and opposition will be much much more unclear than it usually is. But Geert Wilders is expected to have the honour of choosing the Prime Minister. And then the question is, will he pick any other ministers? Possibly, well, because he doesn't really have any candidates in his team of MPs. Yeah. He is the only member of his party, of course. Feife Day do have experienced ministers. They're the only one of the four parties who do. And NSC are also expected to appoint some ministers, because one of the issues was that Feife Day, Dilan Yeşilgöz, was very reluctant to appoint ministers to a Wilders cabinet. But now it's not a Wilders cabinet. She says it's okay. And Peter Omtzigt has kind of said the same thing.
Even though he gets to choose the prime minister.
Yes, yes.
And who on earth is going to be prime minister for Geert Wilders? I mean, who might be sitting in this cabinet then? What names are bandied around already?
Yeah, a few names have been floated around. I don't find any of them very convincing at the moment. We've had Mona Keyser's been put forward. Remember, she was sacked as a junior minister in the last cabinet. She's the only person. Mark Rutte was prime minister for 13 years, and he only ever sacked one minister, and it was Mona Keyser, because she spoke out against.
The only minister that was sacked in history. So, how ironic it would be that she would be Rutte's successor. That would be very ironic, I think.
She's as outspoken as Wilders on Twitter at the moment as well. She's rabbiting on all the time at the moment. So
often to quite a disastrous effect. She rabbited on about the Ukrainian refugees recently, didn't she? She said that there were safe places in Ukraine now. They could all go there. So, yes, well, other names have been put forward have been, Ronald Plasterk and Kim Putters, simply, I think, because Geert Wilders has already appointed them to, you know, important, to pivotal positions in this formation process. Whether they would actually want to take the job, I don't know. Ronald Plasterk is a very wealthy man from his scientific investments. So does he want to really take on the job of Prime Minister? Kim Putters, I think, seems to be much happier being a researcher with the Socioeconomic Council. To be honest, I can't really see why he would take up the job. Johan Remkes has been mentioned. I think he's thrown all his mobile phones in the sea by now, surely, if he's got any sense. And Ahmed Davutoğlu.
And of course, Binnenhof is in such a terrible state that you cannot smoke anywhere near any of the buildings. So,
no
Johan Remkes is also out of the question, I think, now.
Ahmed Davutoğlu, somebody said, but can you read it? I can't believe that Geert Wilders would appoint Ahmed Davutoğlu, or indeed that Davutoğlu would accept the post from Geert Wilders, but it's a name. I think I saw one person suggest it.
I believe Frans Timmermans has said that he will not give permission to any one of his party members to take a ministerial post, let alone the prime ministership, in a cabinet that is supported by Wilders, even though I don't think he has, technically speaking, the authority to do something. But you can always expel someone from the party, even though I'm not sure on what grounds it would be. But Timmermans says no one from the PvdA can step into the cabinet.
So that's a bit of a spanner in the works. But one person who's not going to be in the cabinet is Joost Eertmans, because he immediately he was the first person to step forward and rule himself out. I'm sure there's the person who nobody had even considered for a ministerial post, the leader of a one-man party in the Tweede Kamer, has boldly said that he's not going to, he's going to stay exactly where he is.
He's got quite a lot of experience, though. Knows Abu Talib very well.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yes, and of course, you could definitely call him a non-party minister by dint of the fact he's been a member of so many political parties that he's probably forgotten which one he's in there right now.
Amsterdam's new Holocaust Museum had a controversial opening on Sunday when hundreds of demonstrators turned up to protest at the involvement of Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog. Herzog had been invited last year before the Hamas raids on Israel in October and the Israeli retaliation, but his decision to attend overshadowed the run-up to the event and the day itself. One of the demonstrations was even organised by an anti-Zionist Jewish group, who attracted supporters carrying signs calling for a ceasefire. There were several demonstrations all over the city, and the protests had been kept at a distance from the Portuguese synagogue where the main ceremony took place, but they were clearly audible when the invited dignitaries visited the museum itself. So it wasn't a, you know, great success PR-wise.
Not a great start, was it? No.
No, I mean, basically everything went wrong. I mean, for a start, having Herzog there was a PR disaster. The news leaked out at the weekend. I don't think they wanted it to leak out, but it did. And there was plenty of time to organise protests. Then during his speech, Herzog was quite political, actually, and he called for the safe return of the Israeli hostages. And he only referred to the ongoing military campaign in Gaza by mentioning one soldier who had died a month ago while bravely defending Israel. So that left a bit of a sour taste, I think, on quite a few people's mouths. Then the king repeated himself by saying Sobibor began in the Vondelpark with a sign stating no Jews, which is exactly the same text he used 4 years ago at the Remembrance Day ceremonies in May. So that was slightly unfortunate. That didn't get mentioned, but it really stuck out to me because it's such a vivid thing and, you know, vivid enough to probably use again. You know, let's not blame him too much. But, you know, and then we ended up with these sort of horrible images of the demonstration and the Holocaust survivors walking past a chanting mob to get to a museum which was dedicated to their experiences, you know, 75, 80 years ago. So it was a real mixed bag, actually, how it all worked out.
Yeah, I was surprised that people were surprised that this became, you know, a flashpoint, given, you know, when the president of Israel turns up at any public event at the moment, in the middle of Israel's campaign in Gaza, it's bound to stir up tensions. I mean, it's inevitable, and they should have anticipated that. So who's been blamed for this minor debacle?
Well, Femke Halsema, the mayor of Amsterdam. Yeah, I mean, she's picked up most of the flack because it's her job to deal with law and order and public safety, and people say she should have ensured the demonstration was far enough away from the museum not to be heard or in another part of town altogether. In fact, Mark Rutte had to intervene in her support. He made a statement after Wilders took time out of the coalition talks to attack the mayor for her role in what he called an unprecedented scandal.
Yeah. Wilders, who would have thought that Wilders would opportunistically attack Femke Halsema over a demonstration in Israel, of course, which is an issue that Wilders is constantly banging the drum on anyway.
Yes, no, exactly, exactly. He actually said it was intimated, he didn't say it outright, that it was a political decision by the extreme left-wing mayor of Amsterdam. But Rutte, you know, he said that while everyone had hoped the opening of the museum would pass off peacefully, decisions by mayors on public order issues are non-political. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, but you can't depoliticise a visit by the President of Israel. I mean, it's just not going to happen, is it? And certainly in a very Trumpist language, I thought, used by Wilders as well, calling her an extreme left-wing mayor. You know, so talking about the radical left again, which is something he's been saying about Timmermans as well. So everything kind of came, all of Wilders' current hobby horses all came together in one explosive tweet, really.
No, exactly. It was very sad, you know. And yeah. I think the fact that we've finally got this museum in Amsterdam is quite extraordinary. It's taken so long. When you think about it, you know, 3/4 of the Netherlands' Jewish population were deported and murdered during the war. And the country is still coming to terms with what happened and how it treated the Jews who returned. You know, some found their homes had been taken over by their neighbours or ransacked, their possessions stolen. Some were even sent bills for council taxes covering the period they were away. And more things keep emerging all the time. Just last week, researchers said that Amsterdam's public transport company, the GVB, had sent an invoice to the German government 2 years after the war ended, asking for payment for using its trams to take Jewish people to the main railway station for deportation. And ironically, Anne Frank and her family were on that very last tram journey, and they found proof of that. It's actually in the itinerary and in the list of passengers. And that makes the whole thing, you know, feel very real, actually. And I'm sure it was not inopportune when the news came out, but it kind of gave a human face to the whole thing. And coming on top of the Holocaust museum opening. And, you know, to get back to that museum, it's all about giving faces to the people, to the victims of the Holocaust. And it makes so much of the personal possessions and the photographs and the film. But William Alexander, the king, who had performed the main ceremony, he was asked about the protesters after his visit. And he said, "We should not forget that with the liberation of the Netherlands, the right to demonstrate was brought back. It was not allowed. So as part of that war and the liberation, it is fantastic that we can now demonstrate here."
Yeah, which I think is a very, very important point to underline. And sadly, we had in the days to follow a debate in Parliament where a lot of MPs from various parties, including parties you think of as being on the left, like the Christian Unie, because they're quite pro-Israel, were sort of arguing that people, the right to demonstrate should be restricted. And surely the whole point of demonstrating is that you actually want to be heard by the people that you're the subject of your protest. So,
and the only person that they were protesting about was Herzog. So that was, you know, be at the airport then when he gets off the plane.
So yeah, so sad that kind of overshadowed the museum, but it shouldn't take away from it because, as you say, it's a very significant thing to have here in the Netherlands and important.
The cabinet is expected to announce an order for 4 new submarines from French shipbuilder Naval Group on Friday, according to RTL News. The vessels will replace the outdated, but a podcast favorite, I dare to say, Walrus-class submarines that have been in service since the 1990s. Apart from Naval Group, which is 62.5% owned by the French state, 2 other shipbuilders were in the race to acquire the 4 and possibly 6 billion euro procurement, including the Dutch shipyard Damen, which began a partnership with Swedish firm Saab. The cabinet will officially decide on the tender on Friday, and that will be the final chapter of the submarine replacement saga that has been dragging on for over a dozen years and saw major delays due to ever-changing lists of demands and fierce political opposition because of the extremely high costs.
Mm-hmm. So the Telegraph reported that the French have done absolutely everything to secure the order.
Yes, the French are known for their strong lobby and putting on a big show. You might remember this, Robin. I know I do. Last spring, during the French president's Emmanuel Macron state visit, a massive ship of the French Navy visited Amsterdam and fired 21 salute shots. I was in the city then, and it was absolutely deafening. I was on the other side of the city center, and you could hear it from the eye. But the Telegraph, and this was all part to show, you know, this was the time politicians needed to make a decision on where are we going to order these submarines, and all of a sudden this French ship visits Amsterdam and shows how good they are in building vessels. But the Telegraph reported this week that France went much further than the conventional ways to bring in the order. The newspaper quotes from the book Dit wil je echt niet weten, You Really Do Not Want to Know This, by investigative journalist Huib Modderkolk. And according to him, French security services even spied on Saab in Sweden. According to the book, the French listened in on phones and read internal emails to get insights in and gain an advantage over the joint Dutch-Swedish bid. Mm. And the Telegraph also said that in contrast to Dutch security services, the French security services are allowed to act in the interest, in the industrial interests of France. So that's a nice contrast between France and the Netherlands.
Yeah,
here.
So for the Dutch put themselves at a bit of a disadvantage there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Would the deal with Saab have been swung if Mark Rutte had bought a new car, maybe?
Yeah, he should have just bought one new car. Yeah. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Not everyone's happy that the French are likely to build this new submarine, even though they did such a brilliant marketing job.
No, and it's such a brilliant spy job. No, in particular, SGP leader Chris Stoffer isn't happy. He feels the Dutch submarines should be built by Dutch shipyards, and they will now see most of the multi-billion euro investment go to France. And he argues that the Naval Group could only offer the best price because of the backing by its owner, the French state.
Yeah, but although, of course, if the SGP had their way, then Dutch shipyards would not be able to do any shipbuilding on Sunday, so it would take longer to build the submarines, right? So that's possibly another factor.
Yeah, and the French will be on strike most of the week, so...
True.
Following the news of the cabinet's decision, the Orthodox Protestant Party, whose electoral base coincidentally overlaps with the regions where the submarines were supposedly going to be built, immediately sprang into action, and they hang up hundreds of billboards along the motorways. And on this billboard, you could see Christopher standing in front of an orange submarine with the... I included a photo of it in the
script.
It sounds
like a terrible like Beatles tribute act or something. Yes,
the orange submarine, yeah. So an orange submarine and a caption saying, "Don't let our maritime industry sink." He also requested an emergency debate in the Tweede Kamer, summoning the Deputy Defense and Economic Affairs Ministers to Parliament to explain... a decision that officially hasn't been made yet.
Yeah, I liked what Christopher was quoted as saying in NSA this week as well about the fact that it was this was an urgent decision. Do you remember what he said?
No.
He said, "It is Europa veranda."
But Damon have just won another big order from the Dutch Navy to build whole bunch of frigates. So have they got room to do submarines as well?
Yeah, well, Christopher says that he can't help but think that these sudden picks, these sudden orders for Damen are basically a conciliatory thing for them for
it's
missing
sort of a trade-off,
the submarine.
Is it?
Yeah, that's what he says. Even though it is the timing is interesting, but we'll never know what exactly. Occurred here, I think.
Yeah, but we also had a debate about it in these submarines in Parliament, which was quite an interesting insight into the state of the relationship between the four formation parties, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a very heated debate. As I said, it was requested by the SGP, but Ruben Brekelmans called it the big Christopher show.
Yeah, Brekelmans is from the VVD.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah, the VVD MP, Ruben Brekelmans. He also clashed with the Boer-Burgerbeweging MP Gijs Tuinman. Tuinman accused the VVD MP to be the source of Tuesday's leak to the press. Yeah, Stoffer and Tuinman, they were joined by PVV MP Yuri Pol. Imagine being, your name is Pol and you are PVV MP, now come to think of it.
Yeah, was Yuri Pol not the guy also who was gave a quite pro-Russian speech recently about Ukraine?
That was him.
It was him,
And Pol said the choice for the French would mean the death of the Dutch maritime industry. And VVD and NSA emphasized that the Dutch defense industry will profit from the submarines in any eventuality because the Dutch industrial involvement was one of the main items on the list of demands for the order. So I don't think we will see an orange submarine, but it will be red, white and blue.
Yes, so they'll be sort of equipped with, I don't know, will there be like a Senseo machine in there or something? Like sort of
a baguette heater.
We're not trying to buy a submarine at the Dutch News Podcast, or even a baguette heater, or a Stormwaffel from an Amsterdam street vendor. But your donations are always greatly appreciated because they really do help to keep this podcast running and enable us to keep you up to date with what's going on here in the Netherlands. And in particular, it buys us the time to make the special bonus episodes, like our deep dive into the fiasco of Lelystad Airport that only Patreon subscribers get to listen to. We have 4 tiers of membership to suit your budget, from Kinderdijk all the way up to Grachtengordel. New subscribers get a shout out to say thank you and an invitation to tell us a bit about yourself and ask us a question. And you also get extra votes in the OPF of the Year awards, which are very, very valuable and much coveted. Access to all our bonus content. So this week we say welcome and thank you to new patron Dushi. And special thanks as well to Yelena, who's very generously increased her donation this month. Dushi, our new patron.
Yes,
so thank you very much to both of you and to everybody else who continues to support us. Dushi tells us that she's a young professional based in Chicago, but has been living and working as a digital nomad and is trying to inform herself on what's going on in politics in the Netherlands, although I'm not sure that we've got much of a clue either at the moment, but we do our best. And she does say as well, one question she has is, do you have an episode or any resources to give an overview and summary of how your political system works?
Do we?
It's all over the website, actually. If you just look under elections, 2023, you'll find a whole load of articles in there about how it works. And we'll be doing one again for the Europeans, of course, so how that works too.
Yeah, yeah, we certainly did for the election in November. We did, I think, a whole list of how voting works and how the actual formation process works after the election. So, yeah, there's plenty of resources on Dutch News for that. So hope that helps you untangle things
a
little.
And now you are a Patreon supporter. You can listen to our series we did in the wake of the election in November. We had, what was it, four episodes?
Five episodes. There were 15 parties that we featured, which wasn't all of them, but it was the main ones. And yeah, we did three per episode, and they're all in a little group or a cluster or a folder on the Patreon website. Yeah.
So you can listen to that, and that will give you a nice introduction in most of the political parties that matter, at least in Parliament, in the Tweede Kamer, and we will link to the articles we just mentioned in the liner notes.
Yeah. So if you would like to become a sponsor of the podcast and access all of that bonus content and get to vote in the Opera for the Year Awards more than other people, then go to www.patreon.com/DutchNewsNL.
There's been quite a lot going on with regard to refugees in this past week, and we don't even have a new government to get in on the act yet. Firstly, overcrowding at the Ter Apel reception centre is continuing, and the bill the refugee agency COA has to pay to Westerwolde Council is building up quite nicely. Secondly, the courts have agreed that non-Ukrainian refugees from Ukraine, i.e. the foreign students and the workers who got caught up in the war, can stay in the Netherlands for a little bit longer after all. And thirdly, the Netherlands has been told it can deport asylum seekers to Belgium because this would not infringe upon their human rights.
Now, that sounds contentious.
Well, it's not really. It's not really contentious. It's very straightforward. I mean, Belgium is Belgium. Good food, good chips. No, it's basically Belgium is no longer providing accommodation for single men. They have to go on a waiting list. They don't have enough spaces. And the case was brought by a chap from Angola who reached the Netherlands via Belgium and applied for refugee status here. But of course, under the Dublin rules, he should have applied in the country he arrived in, which was Belgium. So the Dutch refugee minister, Erik van den Berg, wanted to deport him. And the Council of State, which is the country's highest administrative court, has ruled he can be sent back because even though he won't have anywhere to live, he'll still have access to homeless shelters and he'll get food and medical treatment. In other words, a bit like the situation in Ter Apel.
So, yes, you've raised the question of Ter Apel. What's the latest situation there?
Well, you might remember that the same Council of State ordered the COA to make sure that no more than 2,000 people a night sleep in Ter Apel, and that's the legal limit. The local council took the COA to court for repeated overcrowding, and that had led to people sleeping outdoors, if you remember, a couple of years ago. Mm. And it was, you know, not okay in Ter Apel. People were very unhappy about it. I've read that the COA has been attempting to get around the limit by shipping people out at night to sleep in tents in the villages quite close by. Local media, I'm not sure how true it is, but, you know, could well be. Mm. Whatever, the idea, I mean, seems to me so bizarre that a state-run agency, the COA, is paying 15,000 euros a night to the village for every time it breaks the limit is quite bizarre. I mean, couldn't they use that money to buy beds in a hotel? Or, you know, less money for the COA means less money to spend on accommodation for refugees in the first place. So it's just a sort of vicious circle. I don't understand it.
No, it makes no sense. But then you wonder why. I think that the council brought the case because the COA was just completely failing to actually move people out of Ter Apel, and that was leading to appalling and unsanitary conditions. They felt like they have to do something. The only thing they could do was take legal action. So, yeah.
Oh, I mean, I feel for Westerwolde. I mean, I do. I mean, then the poor mayor there who did all the hard work because he's not well. He's out of action.
No, he's been taken to hospital, hasn't he? Yeah.
It's a mess. But it just seems so weird that a state-run agency, a state-owned agency, is having to pay a fine to a local council, which is also local government. It's a sort of another example of this shoving money around. It's like the NS, you know, has to pay a fine to the government, which is its 100% shareholder. I mean,
yeah, or the tax service is fined for, you know, the way it treated the child benefit scandal victims. Which, you know, on the one side, in a moral case, in a moral sense, I guess it makes sense. But on the other hand, you, like you say, it's money just being taken away from the government that could have actually invested in the tax service. So who gains?
Well, they could have invested it in a nice website to scare off British tourists from your capital city.
Yeah.
And there is some news about Ukraine, right?
Yeah, this is about the third country nationals who were living in Ukraine at the time of the Russian invasion. Nearly 3,000 of them fled to the Netherlands, where they've been living for the past 2 years without any problem. But the government has had enough and decided it's time for them to return home. Many of them come from India and Nigeria, for example, which are considered safe places. Since January, when this was announced, 740 of them have applied for asylum in the Netherlands. Van der Berg, by the way, has told them to transfer them to the COA refugee accommodation.
Which is this the same COA that's having a terrible overcrowding problem, doesn't have beds for people? Is that the same one?
That's the one. Yeah, exactly. And they have to also go to Ter Apel to register. Anyway, the others have now been told by the district court in Haarlem, not the Council of State this time, that they can wait until their appeal against being told to leave has been heard and ruled on. And that's supposed to happen on March the 27th. So it's a short reprieve, but it's a very complicated one.
And I guess potentially they could appeal again. So they might yet extend their stay a little longer.
And it'll all go all the way up to the Council of State, which is very busy with refugee cases at the moment.
Sports news. PSV's Champions League adventure is over after they lost 2-0 to Borussia Dortmund in Germany after the two sides had drawn 1-1 in Eindhoven last week. Jadon Sancho put Borussia ahead on aggregate when he drilled in a shot from the edge of the area. PSV pressed and pressed in the second half. Hervin Lozano hit the post. Johan Bakayoko drew a point-blank save from Gregor Kobel, but in the last minute of injury time, Marco Reus, who had already had a goal disallowed for offside, took advantage of a defensive slip and scored a simple second. So it's all over for PSV, and that means that on Thursday night, Dutch hopes in Europe rested with Ajax, who met Aston Villa in Birmingham for the second leg of their Conference League tie, that glamorous competition having drawn 0-0 in Amsterdam. And if they don't succeed, it means no Dutch club will have made the quarterfinals of any of the three European competitions this season.
But there has been a boost for the Eredivisie.
Yes, because Porto went out of the Champions League on Wednesday night on penalties to Arsenal. What's that got to do with Dutch clubs, you ask? Well, it does mean that the Dutch league has secured sixth place in UEFA's coefficient rankings. UEFA just specialise in these incredibly complicated mathematical puzzles. I'm not going to try and explain it, but the effect is that two Dutch clubs will play in the Champions League group stages for the next two seasons, and that's where the real money is. And at the moment, it looks as if that will be PSV and Feyenoord. And the team in third place, they also get a shot at the Champions League. They're drawn in the third qualifying round, and that is currently SC Twente. And three more places are available in the Europa League and the Conference League. So with a little bit of luck, Ajax might actually get into Europe again, Robin.
A little bit of luck, I think, is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's not been going so well the last few weeks.
Not really, no.
But enough about football, let's talk about the real football news, and that is Quincy Promes.
Yeah, Quincy, he's coming home, Quincy's coming home. It looks as if Quincy Promes' sojourn in Moscow may indeed be coming to an end. Last week, we brought you the news that the former Ajax winger was set to escape justice and jump on a plane to Moscow after paying a fine for a traffic offence in Dubai. Promes had been in Dubai with his current club, Spartak Moscow, on a training camp. He seems to have overlooked the fact that the Netherlands recently signed an extradition treaty with the United Arab Emirates. But he was arrested at the airport.
Was that because a notorious cocaine dealer was arrested there?
Yes, ironically, yes. A major league drugs criminal did have a part to play in this recent extradition treaty. Ridwan Taghi, I think you're referring to. Promised to compound his gross stupidity, then managed to get involved in a traffic accident while he was in Dubai and run away and flee the scene. He was arrested at the airport as he was preparing to fly back to Moscow. Initially, it looked he was going to get away with it, seemingly as if there had been some shenanigans going on where Russia had sort of said, well, as long as he pays his fine, why don't you just let him get back on a plane to Moscow next week. But on Wednesday evening, the news broke the promoter had been rearrested at the request of the Dutch prosecution service. This has all been... not a lot has come out about the details of this, but a spokesman for the prosecution service did confirm reports in the Telegraaf that prosecutors were seeking promoter's extradition, but they didn't go into any more detail because they didn't want to jeopardize the process. Promoter's lawyers said an independent judge in Dubai would rule on the request, and it could take some time. So, in the meantime... Yeah, he's just stuck in Dubai.
And you mentioned Taghi, but remind us how Promes ended up in Moscow.
Yeah, he left. He was transferred from Ajax in an awful hurry 3 years ago for a fee of €8.5 million. A few months after he stabbed his nephew at a family party. And Promes was prosecuted for that offence and convicted last June and given a jail sentence of 1.5 years. But the key evidence for that prosecution came from phone calls that were being intercepted during a different police investigation into cocaine smuggling, because it turned out that Promes, along with an accomplice, had been busy organising a shipment of 1,350 kilograms of cocaine from Antwerp. And last month he was sentenced 6 years in prison. And the court in the Netherlands imposed a high sentence partly because Promes was a role model for aspiring young footballers in Amsterdam or everywhere, really.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, really? How can you be so stupid?
Yeah, and not just to go to Dubai in the first place, but then to somehow get yourself in a traffic accident.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'd get mixed up in drug smuggling when you're earning all that money playing international football. Yeah.
I think this Amsterdam website needs to include stabbing your nephew and fleeing to Moscow on their list of things you shouldn't do in Amsterdam.
Yeah, they're definitely banned.
Forest rangers in Drenthe and Friesland are planning to use klaxons and firecrackers to scare off a photogenic wolf that has become too accustomed to humans. The young wolf has been seen approaching people in the nature reserve that spans the two provinces and often seems to pose for nature photographers that are standing on the side of the road.
No.
Yes, this happened. They even had to block a road in one of these nature reserves because too many photographers were basically having a
kind of lining up to photograph this wolf. Yes.
And rangers believe that the animal may have lost its fear of humans after being offered food. And it is, of course, not the first time nature wardens have resorted to unusual measures to deter wolves. In January, Gelderland province won the latest stage of a long-running legal battle to be allowed to use paintball pellets to stop the animals getting too close to humans. I wonder how many how many photographers would a colorful Technicolor Dreamcoat wolf attract, and of course shepherds in the Veluwe region have been given gas horns to use against wolves, but it is unclear if the devices have had any effect. We're going to have to wait and see if the forest rangers in Drenthe and Friesland are going to have success with their klaxons and firecrackers. But they can always use, I think, Joost Klein's Europapa song.
You're talking about young wolves. This is young people's music. They'll be out there, the wolves. They'll be dancing. Yeah. They'll be hacking or whatever you call it.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. We first have to check if this wolf is having an awful moustache to see if he...
A terrible haircut as well.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I think personally it needs signing up, needs an agent. Sounds brilliant to me.
it seems to be very...
And you know what? People are so scared about wolves, we could actually do with them in Amsterdam. That could be the solution for the tourist problem.
Would the wolves be allowed to go on the pub crawls, towards the red light district?
Yeah. They just hang out and look mean on the corners.
Yeah. Well, one thing that might be driving them out to Drenthe is that Drenthe seems to be the latest place to have a spate to start getting bomb attacks as well. Have you seen this? There was a bombing in a Drenthe village, very close to where my Dutch or Drenthe family live. In fact, it's where my mother-in-law grew up.
And there was drug crime has finally reached Drenthe.
But they seem to have flading a toestander in Drenthe. Yeah, there was a bomb placed outside the house of an elderly couple. And it went off at 3 a.m. and people could hear it 4 kilometres away. So probably quite close to where the wolf packs are. So, yeah.
Aren't we sure that the French Navy visited Drenthe to impress some MP going to vote for the...
Could be. And of course, they had that terrible shooting right by the German border as well in Vitefane. So, yeah, it seems like with the wolves and the shootings and the bombs going off, Drenthe seems to be becoming the Wild East.
Crime capital of the Netherlands. I'm shocked and horrified.
I'm off there this weekend, so wish me luck.
Good luck.
Beware of the meth plofferhutten. That's all that we have for you this week. This podcast is a production of Dutch News, which can be found online at dutchnews.nl. We will include links to everything we've talked about today in the liner notes. You can get in touch with us by email to podcast@dutchnews.nl. And if you want to help us out, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating. You can also back us on Patreon at patreon.com/dutchnewsnl and earn yourself a free shout out on the podcast. My thanks to Gordon Derek and Robin Pascoe. Thank you for joining us this week again, and we will be back next week.